This episode of The New Yorker Out Loud is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com/outloud and use offer code OUTLOUD. A better web starts with your website.
This is The New Yorker Out Loud. I'm Curtis Fox from NewYorker.com, and we're listening to a recording of someone playing a trumpet in Thomas Edison's workshop. And here's a man reciting a nursery rhyme. It's hard to make out, but yes, it's Mary Had a Little Lamb. Then the guy starts laughing, kind of a fakey laugh, and then he starts whooping. Apparently, they do this in a lot of those old recordings. This recording was made in 1878. The sound was embedded with a stylus on a strip of tinfoil. Until very recently, Edison got the credit for making the first sound recordings. But several years ago, the world learned that the honor really belongs to a Frenchman.
And this was the work of a medical proofreader and historian of stenography and private chamber inventor named Edward Liam Scott de Martinville.
Alec Wilkinson writes about early recordings in the current issue of The New Yorker.
Scott began experimenting with this technology of embedding his voice in soot.
Soot, that's right. The medium in this case was paper blackened with soot, and his stylus was probably a bristle from a pig. Scott had invented a recording machine, but it didn't have a playback mechanism. The weird thing is, he wasn't even interested in hearing what he'd recorded.
Well, he had a kind of renegade idea that by tracing the sound waves so that they could be read or observed, he thought then a person could learn to read these sound waves.
But it didn't work.
It's one of those fascinating dead ends of science. It came to nothing. No one picked it up.
No one, that is, until the early part of this century, when someone figured out how to play back the sounds that Scott had recorded and had never even heard himself. That's thought to be Scott himself singing the folk song Au Clair de la Lune. It's mind-blowing.
Well, it's especially mind-blowing if you see this piece of paper with squiggly lines on it. It's the most extraordinary combination of multimedia I have ever seen. It's as if somebody wrote words in water, and then by going over the waterfall, they're played.
My name is Carl Haber.
Carl Haber is the man who brought Scott's voice back to life, and many other voices as well.
I'm a senior scientist in the physics division at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory.
Haber is an experimental physicist. He makes very complex machines that are used in colliders, like the one at CERN. Alec Wilkinson spent a lot of time with him to figure out how he and his colleagues created this technology that brings these sounds back to us. Alec, Arthur C. Clarke famously said that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, and that certainly seems to be the case here. Can you tell us how Carl Haber even got the idea for this bit of magic?
Well, he was stuck in a traffic jam, I think it was January of 2000, just south of Oakland, California.
Uh-huh.
And he heard Mickey Hart, the drummer for the Grateful Dead, one of the drummers for the Grateful Dead, talking about how the archive of the world's native musics was deteriorating, mostly because these things were recorded on antique technologies of one kind or another, which aren't standing up really well to time. They're some of them nearly 100 years old and more.
The real dilemma, the preservationist dilemma, is that you have all these wax cylinders and other recordings on various media. The paradox is that if you play them back as they were meant to be played back, you may destroy them simultaneously, right?
Right. These are technology cylinders and discs that were played with a stylus, a needle.
Yeah.
And the pressure of this needle would probably, at this point, because these artifacts have dried out, they're fragile, they're no longer anything like as stable as they were, would be gouged.
So what was Haber's solution to that? How did Haber avoid that?
Well, he, using this technology that he'd used at the CERN collider, which was a kind of measuring tool, a sort of microscope that measured the placement exquisite placement of these detectors in the collision chamber at CERN, where there are 40 million collisions a second. So these detectors have to be very precisely placed. He thought, I might be able to use this technology which measures this placement to instead measure the contour of a groove on a recording. And once I have a contour, digital sound is, after all, a series of points on a graph. Analog sound is something different. It's the tracing of the wave, analogous to the wave. But digital sound is a collection of ones and zeros. So he thought, once I get this map or this tracing or this profile, I can portray it numerically, and the numbers could be read as sound then.
That's amazing.
It is kind of amazing. I mean, Haber doesn't like being lionized. He likes to point out that his discovery is not the kind of moment of inspiration that brings forth a new understanding in the world, but what he did is the second kind of scientific discovery, which is to be aware that there were two disparate technologies in different parts of the world, but that if they were combined, in this case, the measuring device he used at CERN and the capacity for computers to convert numbers to sound, that he could possibly combine the two, and then without touching these artifacts at all, simply subjecting them to a scanning device and recovering their dimensions, making, as it were, a topographical map out of them, he could then play them.
When did Carl Haber first realize that this technology would work?
Well, I think that was around 2000 when they first tried it on a 78 record, which, you know, was an absurdly, I mean, here he is among some of the most highly regarded physicists in America saying, you know, gee, I have this new idea. I'm going to measure the grooves on records. I don't know that he was derided, but I think people thought this is not exactly a high calling. But of course, it's had an enormous impact on being able to save an extremely diverse collection of archival material, from speeches to private laboratory recordings to Aboriginal musics around the world.
Okay, let's take a quick break for a message from our sponsor. We'll be right back.
This episode of The New Yorker Out Loud is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. Squarespace is simple and easy to use, with beautiful design and 24/7 support through live chat and email. When you sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code OUTLOUD. You'll get 10% off your first purchase, and you'll also show support for this podcast. Go to squarespace.com/outloud.
Alec, talk about some of the early recordings that Haber has restored. I understand that he was the first one to allow us to hear what Alexander Graham Bell actually sounded like.
Bell had this lab in Washington, D.C., which he called the Volta Lab, and he was working on a lot of things, but among them was sound recording. Alexander Graham Bell left the contents of the Volta Lab to the Smithsonian.
So these recordings from Volta Lab have been sitting in the Smithsonian for years without any expectation that they're ever going to hear them.
Well, in some cases, they don't even know what's on the discs or cylinders. They're not even archived. I mean, they're archived under Alexander Graham Bell Volta Lab and possibly a date.
Right.
But unless Bell or someone working in his lab wrote down what the content of the disc is, they don't know. So when they're played, they're a complete discovery. And you know, the expectation is that they're holding these things until someday a technology exists that will unlock them, which is what Haber delivered. But it was a complete surprise to find the one that Haber managed to play, which has Alexander Graham Bell speaking, because it's the first time anyone alive, of course, had heard his voice. He recorded it in the 19th century.
And there's also a recording of somebody, maybe Bell, but it's probably somebody else, saying Mary had a little lamb. But then something screws up in the equipment, and he says an obscenity. It sounds like he could have been swearing, could have been, but it's not totally clear, is it?
No, it's not completely clear. It seems to be, but no, it's not unambiguous. Haber likes to think that's what it is, the first recorded obscenity.
There's been some discussion about this. I've listened to it now over and over again, and I'm pretty sure it is. I think you should probably let your listeners decide. What's, you know, kind of striking about it is that it's the first recording, at least that we've come across, and it dates, I think, to 1884 or 1885, that you kind of catch people off guard. I mean, they're not posing for the recorder. They're not making this very deliberate recitation, which most early recordings are very deliberate. You know, you hear his personality pop out. I think that's nice. You're seeing a, you know, a kind of a person off guard, actually caught spontaneously on a recording.
Well, I'm sure as an experimental physicist who builds machines and encounters many difficulties that you have occasionally employed the same word.
Well, not me, but I can assure you that in the research laboratory, I have encountered this word when things aren't going well many, many times.
Alec, what's the value of all this? Obviously, it's a lot of fun to hear what Alexander Graham Bell sounded like and hear somebody swear. But what's the value, ultimately, of recovering all these old recordings?
Well, there's actually a multiplicity of advantages in it. One, of course, is the ability to unlock these cylinders of Native American languages, a number of which are dead, and be able to hear what they sounded like, what kinds of songs the people sang, what kind of stories they told. So there's that sort of academic element to it. There are all kinds of musics that haven't been heard. You know, it is as if notebooks have been found from all over the world that exist, but we don't know what the code is that they're in. And somebody has now devised the code so we can read what these archives are. These things still exist. They might have disappeared, but they now have new life. They are now among us again because of this technology.
Alec, thanks so much.
Sure.
Alec Wilkinson's piece on Carl Haber and his audio technology is in the current issue of the magazine. You can subscribe to The New Yorker Out Loud and other free New Yorker podcasts in the iTunes store. If you're already a magazine subscriber, you have free access to the digital edition of The New Yorker. Download the app in the App Store or Google Play. With the digital edition, you get the print magazine, plus videos, audio, and more.
It's the most extraordinary combination of multimedia I have ever seen.
The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available at audible.com. The New Yorker Out Loud podcast is edited by Owen Agnew and produced by NewYorker.com. I'm Curtis Fox.